Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and today we are back with another episode of the My Side series. Too often, football is seen as tribalistic, as fans display blinkered obsession for their football team and make outlandish claims via terrorist chants that their team is by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. However, within these claims of blind faith and devout following lies eras and teams which crystallise why supporters love their team or are prepared to suffer the recurring heartache. On even rarer occasions, you find a fan of football who can see the beauty and excellence in the side that lies beyond the confines of their own club's history. My Side is an in-depth discussion with a different guest each episode about a side that made an eternal impression upon them. It's either a club side over a single season or an international side at a major championships, discussing the key protagonists, the major incidents, the legacy and much more. My Side is the personal story of a love affair between a football fan and a side that defines their love of the beautiful game. Delighted to say that my co-host for this series is my good friend and kindred spirit, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are we?
Oh, we're very well, thanks, Stu. How's everything your end?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Again, another episode to look forward to. Certainly a very passionate fan, I think, is probably what we've got on our hands tonight.
Yeah, I think we're on to a winner. I mean, we're talking more contemporary terms than we perhaps have done. I think this is possibly the most recent of all teams we've done, but a fine team and a fine vintage at that.
It is, and you're right. It is probably the most recent team that we've covered, and it'll be interesting, obviously, for you and I, who are a lot older, shall we say, that we'll be able to think back to some sort of other editions of this side that you and I probably know a lot better, but which is going to be good because we're going to get a new perspective on a more, like you say, a more contemporary team, and certainly getting an insight is good for us.
Yeah, completely. Because I mean, that's it with this team in particular. There's a team from the mid '80s that are probably one of the first ones that spring to my mind that pushed Liverpool very, very close for a league title. And we're in with a bit of a hunt of the double at one point. FA Cup winning, one of my first memories. FA Cup was in winning it.
Yeah, I was going to say, took the words right out of my mouth there. Yeah, it's one of my first FA Cups.
Yeah, a glancing head on a very hot and sunny day at Wembley. that's the version of them that I grew up with. But this is a vintage of them that I've had to look into, and that's one of the interesting things is that I scratched my head a little bit when I first heard it and thought, right, I've got to look at this and what happened. And even though it's only kind of like a few years ago, you're thinking, and then when I've gone back and looked and thought, yes, it's all kind of like clicked in, thought, yeah, I remember this now. So whereas kind of like 20, 30 years ago, I can rattle off all of the team that we played and how it all went. There was almost more research that I had to do for this one than any of our podcasts so far. But within that, that's been great.
It is. And like you said, so it's always, always good to learn. So today's guest, a writer for These Football Times, making a very welcome debut on our podcast, and certainly someone I think has been itching to get on this series, which obviously is always good. You know, we're always after fans of football, we're always after people who are passionate about their sides. So I hope you might have guessed by now, but delighted to say that tonight we're going to be talking about a side that I think has an incredibly rich history that sort of runs throughout the English game. And as you and I have just said, Stephen, there were multiple sides that could have been chosen by our guest, and he has selected a very contemporary side. And I think as we progress tonight, there will be a clear demonstration about his affinity with this side and why this side is his side. Tonight we're talking about the West Ham United 2015-2016 side, and it's a big welcome to Mr. Danny Lewis. Danny, you all right?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, very, very good. Like I say, same with Stephen, been watching, spent plenty of time watching some YouTube videos and doing a bit of reading, and always never need an excuse to watch a bit of football on YouTube. So I thank you for that in advance.
No worries.
So obviously it's West Ham. It's 2015-16. But, you know, before we get into the real nitty-gritty of your side, I suppose just a bit of background on yourself, really, and your love of football and the supporting of the side that you do.
Yeah, so I first started really getting into football around the 2002 World Cup. You know, I'd sort of been into it a little bit before then, but there was just something about it that really captured my imagination. And then, you know, when I was thinking about who I was going to pick for this series, my other idea was the Brazil team of that tournament, because obviously how, like, dazzling they were. But then, you know, I started going to games that same year with my dad to Upton Park, and I ended up being a season ticket holder for 11 years. I went to FA Cup final. I went to playoff finals. You know, I've seen us in Europe, not away, unfortunately. You know, I've seen us get relegated, have mid-table mediocrity, basically anything you could, you know, come across as a fan. You know, I've pretty much had it, even though I've not been a fan for as long as some other people because of my age. So, yeah, that's pretty much my story of how I fell in love with football.
It actually is, it's really funny what you've just mentioned there, talking about sort of the ups and downs, you know, of the club and the side. And it, I suppose it's a great point, isn't it, Stephen? You almost, to be a fan of a club where there is always something happening, be it relegation, be it playoff final defeat, be it promotion, be it a major final, there's something about the ups and downs that I think football fans actually crave, rather than just that mid-table mediocrity safety. I think that's what football fans are after.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, you know, as much as you don't want your team to get relegated and stuff like that, you're definitely more engaged when it comes to those final stages of the season. And if there's actually something to play for, rather than, oh yeah, we might finish 12th or we might finish 14th, like, it doesn't really matter as much then. And yeah.
Obviously, Stephen, your opinion will be, you maybe can't quite relate to that. It's either a major final or it's not a major final, certainly at the moment anyway. And obviously you've been brought up on the success of Liverpool Football Club, but in terms of that, you know, the ups and downs of a football fan, I think West Ham United are one of those clubs that know how to put their fans through it.
Oh, completely. I mean, from one extreme to the other. I think you know, I've often looked at other teams and tried to gauge how, you know, a supporter like roughly my age would have felt over that same period of time. And, you know, for a team to be constantly stuck in, like, mid-table, mid to lower table, top-flight team, you know, compared to someone like, you know, a West Ham fan my age who's seen so many things, from FA Cup success to, like Danny says, you know, relegations and you know, near misses on promotion back and then promotion again. And, you know, there's been no shortage of interest. And like Danny says, being engaged, no matter what that is, it's whether that's a shooting for the stars or fighting to stay up. The fact that there's always something there, and West Ham always seemed to be one of those clubs that seems to be involved in something or other, whether that was a great cup run, a qualification for Europe, and yeah, they tick those boxes. And of the London clubs, they've always been one of those ones that have completely intrigued me, a bit like QPR and another one in that respect. You know, those teams that have had a history of stylish football and trying to play football the right way with the ball on the floor, and not giving in to kind of like playing the percentages, you know, and I just find them a fascinating club.
It's funny. I mean, Danny, obviously, you know, with your age and Steve and I are old, we are old and we feel old. You know, there's been some fantastic West Ham sides, you know, some great sides. You can't help how old you are. You can't help your footballing experience. And, you know, you talk about, you know, the Brazil, potentially the Brazil side of 2002. But, you know, you've gone with West Ham 15, 16, you know, brilliant, great choice. Like Stephen said, as you look at it, you're like, yeah, I get it now. I see that. I can understand why. But obviously for everyone else then, if you just want to sort of introduce this side to us and sort of set the scene for the start of this season.
Well, so I was a season ticket holder for 11 years at Upton Park, and the final season there, which was the 15-16 season, was by far the best I ever had. You know, we only lost 3 league games at home. You know, you read the players' names and they're maybe not the most eye-catching, but, you know, even when you're looking at how they did compared to other seasons they've had, I mean, Mark Noble, that season, it was by far his best season of his career, in the opinion of many West Ham fans. You know, we had Dimitri Payet, who came. We had Lanzini, who was in his first season. You know, there were so many different players, and there was a real mix of a couple of homegrown players, because we had Tomkins as well, and then you had the foreign stars who had been a bit unknown before. So it just had a bit of everything, really, I'd say.
You know, we could have picked any sort of West Ham side, and you've gone with this side. But just sometimes, when you are a fan of your club, Danny, it's almost like you can't quite put your finger on it. It's a mixture of, like you said, people who arrive at the club. It's a mixture of talents. It's a mixture of personalities. You know, and you mentioned the fact that it was the last season at Upton Park. And all of a sudden, just these little disparate parts just seem to come together to just create this sort of 9 months, this, you know, this sort of football season that is, just happens to be more memorable than all the rest.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd say the only season in my lifetime that's probably got close to that is the year that we got to the FA Cup final.
Oh, was that against Liverpool?
Yeah, it was. I was up there.
I had my
hair dyed carrot and blue and everything, and we ended up losing.
I mean, obviously, leading up to this season, you know, what was happening at West Ham United? You know, what was going on at Upton Park? What was going on at West Ham United? Because obviously there was, you know, there would have been an awareness that it was going to be the last season at Upton Park and the club would be moving. But leading up, you know, in the sort of preceding years leading up to it, how, you know, what sort of situation was the club in? How, you know, how did you feel about the club?
Well, we'd been, you know, fairly mid-table the last couple of seasons. And, you know, all of the talk really was just about the fact that it was going to be the last season at Upton Park. And it, to me, it was very strange at the time because, you know, obviously one of the main things you associate with your club is the stadium that you go to. So you sort of realised that everything was going to be changing fairly dramatically pretty soon. And yeah, when it actually came up to the season, I just remember hoping that we weren't going to get relegated. Because obviously we hadn't done anything of particular note up until that point after getting promoted. So yeah, it would have just been a bit embarrassing to be going into this massive new stadium and playing some like bog standard championship team or something like that in it.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it, Stephen? It's, you know, sometimes, you know, in football, you know, you think the pressure comes from relegation, from winning a cup, going on a good cup run. But I suppose in that respect, for West Ham United, and, you know, Danny's made a great point there, that the pressure of going into this brand new stadium, as what, you know, as was the Olympic Stadium for 2012, the pressure to be a top flight side going into that season. It was probably the biggest pressure they'd probably played under in quite a while.
Oh, huge pressure. You know, it's this golden egg that they've been, delivered. And to play championship football would have been absolutely disastrous for them. But I think maybe that pressure manifested itself very early because they did lose the opening two home games. But as Danny said, they only lost three. It's mad how that happened in that they stutter early, but then they're off and away. And Upton Park becomes this in almost kind of like bomb-proof, impenetrable fortress of old for one last ride, almost basically to roll back those years, and the spectre of the move certainly on the pitch must have melted away to an extent, because they certainly didn't play with a fear, that season.
Obviously, Dan, there's lots, like you say, you've talked about the players arriving, but obviously I would argue not the most important person, but certainly, the appointment of Slaven Bilic and how that got, if we're talking about temperament and characters and, bringing life to something, what was your sort of thoughts and opinions on the appointment of Slaven Bilic?
I think it was vital, really. I think, with the pressure that we've spoken about, it could have either sort of crushed the team or pushed them on. And I think having a manager who had an affinity with the fans was quite an important part of making sure that had a positive impact. And we'd gone from, Sam Allardyce, who, fair enough, he was pretty good for us, but he definitely didn't have the best relationship with the fans. I mean, my personal memory of Sam Allardyce as West Ham manager, apart from getting us promoted, is that we lost, it's either 4 or 5-0 in a cup game against Nottingham Forest, and he played a bunch of kids. And he basically, in the press interview after, he basically said the West Ham fans don't know what they're talking about and all that sort of thing. So it's like when you've just got absolutely battered in the cup, that's not really the best way to get your fans back on side. So, that's one of my main memories of him, as I say, apart from the playoff final, which was obviously fantastic. So to go from that to Bilic, where, when he was a player, he refused to leave West Ham until, I think it was that they wanted to sign him in January, but he refused to sign until the summer so he could help make sure the West Ham stayed up. So he was already fondly thought of from that. So that definitely helped him a lot, I would say.
Stephen, you look at your club Liverpool and their tradition of appointing from within the boot room and the success that had. But having, your thoughts on appointing former players or appointing managers, like Danny said, where there's that affinity with the fans, and how important that actually is to a football club.
Yeah, it's a very fine line because it's a call that can be, an emotional one rather than a scientific one or a cold theoretical one, and it's a fine line because it can go wrong sometimes, but on other times it can be wonderfully, wonderfully correct. And this was with Bilic, but Bilic was did such a wonderful job with Croatia, qualifying for Euro 2008 at the expense of England on that infamous rainy night at Wembley. He'd proved his credentials as a good manager, a very, very good manager, and then to come and try in the Premier League was a huge step, but it was the perfect place for him. He'd been such a hero at West Ham, and he'd been such a fantastic player, one of the best centre-backs of his era, without a shadow of a doubt. And there was just this, maybe not an automatic and an immediate click, but it soon very much clicked into gear between the two of them again, and they were the perfect combination for that season.
I mean, like you say, you forget. You know, sometimes you know time goes quickly, and you know, and you associate Bilic, the manager. But you're right. You know, as a centre half, as a defender, he was a, you know, he was an excellent, outstanding player.
Oh, he was phenomenal. He was, strong, and he could use the ball. He was an intelligent, you know, central defender. He wasn't just this big inordinate lump, you know, that was impossible to get around. He knew football. He could read the game, and he was because people used to talk about kind of like the way he would play in terms of kind of like how Bobby Moore would play at times. His reading the game was that good.
I mean, Danny, you know, we've sort of mentioned Dimitri Payet, and I'm sure, you know, he's going to crop up in conversation, you know, sort of quite a bit over the duration of this podcast and this episode. Obviously, you know, he was a new arrival to Upton Park and to West Ham for that season. But who else arrived at the club ready for that sort of 15-16 season, and which players were sort of let go, you know, going into that season?
Well, Manuel Lanzini joined from Al Jazeera. It was initially on loan, so when he played in 15-16, that was a loan, and obviously got signed up after. And then we also brought in Mikel Antonio, Angelo Ogbonna, and Pedro Obiang. I'd say probably Mikel Antonio had arguably the biggest impact that season with some of the goals he scored. And then Alex Song, Carl Jenkinson and Victor Moses also came in on loan and sort of played their own little parts. Stuart, in terms of the people that left, there was Stuart Downing, Colton Cole, Guy Medel and Jussi Jääskeläinen. And the biggest one who left was probably Kevin Nolan, because obviously he was our captain at the time. And the fact that he left allowed Mark Noble to sort of come in and be undisputed captain.
And do you think that, you know, is there any of those players that went, you know, see, I mean, you've listed some quite notable talents, Stuart Downing, Colton Cole, you know, Kevin Nolan. Is, you know, in your opinion, was it right at that time for those players to go, or are there any of those that you wish maybe had stayed and contributed that season?
I think, perhaps surprisingly, the one that we probably could have done with the most was Guy Demel. He certainly wasn't the best, but that season we sort of had quite a few struggles at left back, at right back, you know, with Carl Jenkinson picking up injuries and things like that. So Tomkins and Antonio sort of had to fill in there. And obviously Antonio ended up getting the ump a little bit with the fact that he had to be going in at right back, fairly understandably. So yeah, I'd say out of those, Guy Demel would have been the most useful.
It's, I mean, like you say, Steve, you know, we've done a bit, you know, and looked at clips. We've read bits on this season, and you know, you look at the names, and you know, obviously Dimitri Payet is the obvious standout, but you know, Mikel Antonio, Carl Jenkinson, Victor Moses, players that left, Stuart Downing, Carlton Cole, Kevin Nolan. Like you say, it was only three seasons ago, and you forget the talent that was coming and going through the doors of Upton Park at that time.
Yep, you really do. I mean, even to, you know, the basis of Andy Carroll, often lamented Andy Carroll, you know, he scored a great deal of goals that season compared to the amount of games that he actually played. You know, his goals per game ratio was actually quite massive. Yeah, and that was the thing about this West Ham, is that there was this, you know, wonderful collection of players. Like, they just kind of like they gelled so well, and it was the diversity of the players as well. You know, the fact that, you know, Mark Noble, it's West Ham through and through, and it was brilliant to be able to see a player like Mark Noble, you know, come through at West Ham and prosper for so long, and he's seen so many managers and eras come and go, yet he remains the same, and a player like that is just, I think, completely admirable. But yeah, it will always come back to Dimitri Payet with this particular side, though, as the cherry on what is a very good cake, basically. You know, I think everyone, you know, no matter what team you support, everyone sat up and took notice of the football ball he was playing and the goals, the epic goals he was scoring.
I mean, you're right, and like I say, and Dimitri Payet will, you know, like I say, he will crop up throughout this. But I'm quite interested, Danny. Obviously, you know, West Ham has this, you know, this tradition of producing very talented, you know, footballers through their youth and through their academy and bringing them onto the first team and then, you know, onto England international. So, you know, going into this season, was there any, with regards to youth, you know, was there any injection of youth at any point in this season?
Well, there was Reece Oxford who started the season fantastically, marking Mesut Ozil out of the game. But obviously he faded away a little bit as it went on and has continued to do so. We bought Sam Byram in the January transfer window, but he didn't really play that much. And then there was Reece Burke, who played in the Cups a bit as well, who's been sold now. But while there wasn't much youth, I'd say that, you know, in terms of having players who had come through the academy in Noble and Tompkins was very important.
We've sort of, you know, we've arrived at the point, and we usually get here around about the 25, sort of 30-minute mark, where, you know, the guest gets to introduce their sort of principal 1 to 11. How you introduce them is completely up to you. People do it in a whole sort of different way of doing it. But if you just want to talk us through who you saw as the principal 1 to 11 for this particular side.
Okay, well, obviously there was Adrian in goal, who was, you know, such a character and was also a very good goalkeeper, as Liverpool fans are potentially finding out now. I don't know if everyone agrees.
I can put my hand up and agree with that.
Yeah. See, I'd have James Tompkins at right back in mind because I preferred Mikel Antonio when he was further up. And then we had Winston Reid and Angelo Ogbonna at centre back. Obviously, you know, Winston Reid has his injury problems now, but at the time, you know, he's the one who scored the last ever goal at Upton Park. And he was, you know, he scored some really important goals for us, actually. You know, back when we were in the Championship, he scored the winner against Millwall. He was just solid at the back. And then you also had Ogbonna, who sort of came in and seamlessly slotted in, I'd say. He was very good for us. And I remember him scoring a header against, I'm pretty sure it was Liverpool in the FA Cup or the League Cup. It was one of the two. But yeah, that was a brilliant moment from him. You had Aaron Cresswell, who, you know, he played really well for us, especially before he got his injury in pre-season a couple of years back. Before that injury, he was, you know, one of the best left-backs I've seen us have, although the competition probably isn't that great. You had Lanzini, who came in and really made an impact straight away, hence why we got him on a permanent deal, and he's now arguably our best technical player alongside Anderson and Haller. The Dimitri Payet, who, as we've spoken about already and probably will again, was just incredible that season. You had Mark Noble and Cheick Kouyaté, who both played better than I've seen them play in the other season. Carroll, as we've mentioned, was better than he's been before, and even Diafrasaka was good. And honourable mention to James Collins as well, because he was brilliant for us.
It's, I mean, you know, like you say, when you go through this 1-11, you know, like we've said, you forget that the talent that was there that season, and you're right. You know, just sometimes players, you know, raise their game, and I suppose as a West Ham fan, you know, you're gonna be the best, certainly the best person for me to ask. Luckily, is what was it that brought out the best of them? In that particular season, you've talked about Mark Noble and his performances. You just talked about Kouyaté and his performances there, and Andy Carroll, and I suppose I'm interested in what you think it was that brought all of those players and sort of got them to play at such a high level over the season. I'm just wondering what you thought the main reason for that was.
Well, I think there was a very good like mix of skill sets within the side, first of all. I mean, you know, Andy Carroll getting on the end of Dimitri Payet's crosses, like, it's bound to work. But then there was also the atmosphere around the stadium, and just this, there was this feeling whenever you turned up that we could win, and, you know, it was almost like, you know, they've got to do it because it's the last season at Upton Park, so if they're not going to do it now, you know, there's never going to be anything this special again. So I guess there was this sort of like heightened sense feeling that I'd imagine went down to the players during the games as well. And I'm sure that Slaven Bilic really harnessed that to get the best out of them.
And do you believe that, you know, and it's interesting what you said there, you know, with regards to the, I suppose, the Upton Park factor and the fact that it was the last, the last season there. And I mean, that's quite difficult to sustain that intensity of performance across a whole season. But it's interesting, you know, and do you actually think that it was actually the fact that this was going to be the last season at Upton Park and that's what constantly drove those, certainly those home performances?
Yeah, I definitely think at home. I mean, obviously away, it was probably a completely different story. But, you know, there was stuff around the ground to commemorate like what had gone before, and there was videos all the times and bits in the program, and there was that little bit of extra edge in the atmosphere. And you know, you hear players often say it, that, you know, they have their 12th man and cliches like that, and you know, they sort of feel like they really get pushed on by the fans when they're really on it. And you know, to have that for every single home game, you know, no matter how good your atmosphere is, the fans aren't going to be incredible every game unless it's a really special season. And that's obviously what it was for us.
I mean, Stephen, I would assume you've been to Upton Park.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And yeah, certainly. It was a brilliant, brilliant place to watch football. You know, so compact and close to the pitch and atmospheric, and just one of those brilliant traditional football grounds of the English game that, you know, I absolutely hate to see disappear.
It's funny, I was just about to ask when you finished there, I was just about to ask Danny, because it's very rare that I can relate to anything in these conversations, but this time I actually can relate. So obviously Hull City were at Boothby Park, which was, you know, which was not like at Upton Park, but obviously they moved into the KCOM. Now for me, the KCOM stadium, it's a wonderful, wonderful stadium. Now whether that was due to the sort of derelict state that Boothroyd Park found itself in, but it, you know, for me, it's a far better playing environment. Obviously, Stephen, you have Anfield that you've always been at, you've always known as a football fan, and you know, you've seen it developed and added to, but you've always stayed at the same place. And then we come to you, Danny, whereby, you know, you had this wonderful football ground, this really traditional, and as Stephen said, you know, all the fans were so close to the pitch, and it always came across to me as such an incredible, intense, traditional football environment. And comparing it now to the stadium you're in, I'm obviously quite interested in how you feel about the stadium move.
Yeah, well, another thing with me and the whole final season at Upton Park and the move, and a lot of it is to do with timing. And I actually gave up my season ticket the season after, like, our first season in London Stadium because of like university commitments and things like that. So it really didn't help my feeling of connection that having gone every other week for 11 years, I was suddenly going, you know, like 10 times a season. And even though that's still a fair amount, it didn't really help my personal transition into it. And, you know, like even now, you know, like I miss Upton Park like all the time. People get fed up with me talking about it sometimes, because when I go on about Upton Park, I can blab on for quite a while. But yeah, it's just completely different. And, you know, there were a lot of teething problems because of probably how different it was. But even to this day, like, it just doesn't compare. I don't think it will ever... I mean, obviously, it will never be the same. You sort of hope that it could one day be as good, but I personally don't see it being as good. But even, you know, the songs that were sung, I don't really hear that much anymore. Like the Ludo McCroskey one, I don't really hear that whenever I go. Like little things like that. When we're in the London Stadium, sometimes, you know, they're just like clapping repeatedly. There wasn't even any chanting. And I'm like, that didn't happen once at Upton Park. So it's just, yeah, it's changed a lot. And I personally don't think it's as good.
Do you think, so I'll just throw an extra question.
Yeah, good. Go.
Would you say that's just the ground itself, or has it kind of like made you feel slightly differently about the team in full, you know, as a full entity almost?
I feel.
Does it still feel like West Ham to you? There was a conversation we had with Matt Guy not too long ago on another podcast, and in a similar situation, you know, we spoke about the Dell, another ground that I went to and absolutely adored going to, no matter how ramshackle it became, and then the shift to St Mary's, and from a visiting perspective, a team that moves ground, suddenly, it's not that they're not West Ham anymore, it's not that they're Southampton anymore, but they just don't feel like the Southampton or the West Ham that I knew, and somehow something's just that bit different about the club in general. They're just not quite that team that they were. There's still a form of that team, of that club, but that old feeling about it, and we only spoke about it the other night, about various football competitions, how they felt. You know, the UEFA Cup had a distinct feeling, and the Europa League does not mirror that. You could say that that's the same type of thing, but, you know, what's your perspective on that, Danny?
Yeah, I'd definitely say the other thing that sort of plays into this is the fact that they changed the badge the same season that we moved stadium. So it's like, it's okay, you're changing the stadium and you want us to be the same club, but then you go and change probably the second biggest factor of what a club actually is, their stadium and their badge. You've changed them both at the very same time. You know, we lost Tompkins that season to Crystal Palace. So, you know, it's sort of like these small, well, they're fairly big things when you put them together. They were all taken away at the same time. So I remember sitting there just thinking, you know, I'm not quite as into this as I was before. You know, I remember when we sung I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles for the first time in there, it felt more like a gimmick than having the same passion. But I feel like that sort of faded a little bit. It's still not as good. But then all those sort of things make you feel more disconnected with the team. But I do feel like, you know, having Declan Rice come through has helped that a fair bit for me. Because one of my things with supporting the team was like, oh, I love such and such player. Like, everyone has these players that they sort of feel they can connect with. And I'd say Declan Rice is one of those players. And the fact that we had Mark Noble and still have him has sort of helped save that.
It's a fascinating tangent that we've gone off. And I'm sat here listening, and I'm thinking back to you know, everything you've just said there, Danny. I mean, I'm not a diehard Hull City fan. It's the city that I live in, and I do go and watch them. But you know, they, and listening to you talk there about changing the ground and then changing the badge all in the same season, and it must have felt like you say the club must have felt unrecognisable. You're right, it's the same players, the same manager, But you're right, once your ground identity has changed, once the badge has changed, and I think back to Hull City, and you know, and they've changed grounds, you know, and they changed owners since, but then, you know, the new owners came and they changed the badge, and then they wanted to change the name of it, you know, change the name of the club. Hull City have always been known as, you know, as the Tigers, you know, as their nickname, but all of a sudden they wanted it incorporated into the actual name of the football team, and it sounds like such a simple thing and a simple change, and somebody who is not passionate about their football club, someone who doesn't live and breathe their football club, maybe won't understand the massive impact that a name change or a badge change or a, you know, a bigger thing like a ground change, it really does almost create turmoil inside of a football fan, because, you know, Stephen and I have chatted quite a bit about this, and usually, you know, in times of change and turmoil, and we're living in times of change and turmoil at the moment, but a football club is always a constant that people can rely on, and it's always something that's always there, and it never moves, it never goes away. Something will always happen every other Saturday, and you will always collect, the same people will go to the same place. But when it starts to be changed and moved around, it really does have a massive impact on how people feel, and I think that can't be underestimated.
Yeah, definitely. And one more thing I'd add with that is it's also the community around the ground. And, you know, you're walking up towards the ground. And, you know, I can still picture now, you know, when you're walking up to Upton Park, you've got the pie and mash shop on the way. You've got the bloke selling Overland and Sea fanzine, which stopped after we moved from Upton Park. You had the guy selling sweets. It was like 3 bags for £1. You know, there's so many little things that help make up your match day experience. And that's the one thing that doesn't really get taken into account by people from the outside, because obviously they don't see that. They see just the inside of the stadium rather than everything that goes with it.
I mean, Stephen, you know, you and I have talked about this on so many different podcasts, and it's something that seems to keep reoccurring. And the importance within society of football clubs, and you've talked about it a lot, that match day routine. Do you ever have a fear that Liverpool would ever move from Anfield?
Well, it was a possibility. You know, there was talk of new stadiums and although it was only a projected move onto Stanley Park at one point, and there were other places around the city that was talked about. So a shift from Anfield to Stanley Park was only going to be a short one, but still it wasn't going to be, you know, exactly where it was. You know, it is that footprint. It is walking past. You know, it's where you park. It's where you go for a pre-match pint. It's the chippy you use. It's the sweet shop you might walk into. You know, you get used to people that you see. You don't know them, but you know them. You might not even know the name, but you walk past them year after year and led onto them. And, you know, it's the people that you sit near. You know, we had a short, smaller version of it with the rebuild on the main stand. So we were moved from one place to another. So we lost a lot of the people that we used to share the game with. But it's still the same place. It's still the same footprint. I can still look on that pitch and see the goals of the past. You know, I can still say that's still the same ground. Even though it's changed on all four sides, it's still the same place that my dad took me to for the first time in, you know, late 1977 to watch Liverpool play Hamburg for Keegan's return in Hamburgshire. And I take huge comfort in that, you know, and find it, you know, an almost spiritual experience in that respect. And I can fully understand exactly where Danny and indeed Matt came from in those assertions, is that something changes. And it isn't just about the club itself, the colours and the fact that they still have that name. It's where they are. It's that footprint and everything that goes with it.
Obviously, you know, Danny, we're going to look at, you know, sort of key moments in the season now, you know, and I fully appreciate, like you say, this building up as the season went along to leaving Upton Park and playing at that last game there. But, you know, coming in this sort of 15-16 season then, where for you were the key games, the key moments?
Well, the first one was actually a loss. It's a pretty embarrassing one when we lost against Astra Giurgiu in the Europa League qualifier. And at the time, I was well and truly gutted about this because I've craved European football ever since we first went into, I think it was the UEFA Cup, and we got Palermo and we lost like 4-0 on aggregate. And ever since then, I thought I really want a European run. And I thought we were going to be getting it in the final year at Upton Park, and it obviously didn't turn out that way. And then, you know, obviously there were very good results as well. Opening day of the Premier League season, you know, the fact that we beat Arsenal 2-0, it sort of set a good tone. And I guess it also shows that, you know, as much as Upton Park was the theme of the season, that we could actually do well away from home as well as at home, because obviously you can't get any sort of real success from just being good at home. Then we lost, you know, against Leicester and AFC Bournemouth, and they were two pretty, you know, obviously at the time we didn't realise that Leicester were going to go on and win the league.
Yeah.
So I was sitting there thinking, God, we've just lost against Leicester and Bournemouth. So our last year at Upton Park, and we're going to lose the majority of the games here. And obviously it didn't turn out like that because we didn't lose until our penultimate home game there. But, you know, that really wasn't a great game against Swansea. But, you know, even the fact that we lost that game, it sort of shows the fate of how, you know, we were meant to have that final game at Upton Park under the lights against Man United rather than getting battered by Swansea. Yeah, in terms of, you know, some influential games as well, I personally would say when we drew against Everton, because McCarthy injured Payet with a pretty poor challenge, and, you know, people can call me a conspiracy theorist or something like that, but I'd say that if Payet hadn't been injured, because he was such a quality player, if he had been there, you know, we drew a lot of games while he was away, and I think his quality would have helped to potentially tip those into our favour, so we could have ended up finishing even higher. We at home, we beat Chelsea, we beat Liverpool, we obviously beat Spurs, which was very, very satisfying. And then we drew against Arsenal and Man City as well. The FA Cup run that ended against Man United, which was very frustrating, that game. And then, yeah, then the final game against Manchester United, which was the best game I've ever been to in my life.
We'll come to that. You know, I know, you know, obviously it's, you know, I suppose it's the moment that this season has been leading up to, and it, you know, and it's the moment that, you know, like we say about, you know, we try and crystallise a side into a single season, but you can almost crystallise this side into a single game. And we'll come to that in just one second. But looking at some of those key games, Stephen, that, you know, that Danny's just rattled off, and like I said, I people got caught up with Leicester City in that season and got caught up with, you know, with the Leicester City story, and rightly so. But, you know, you look at those, you know, defeating Chelsea, defeating Liverpool, draws against Arsenal, Manchester City, beating Spurs. I mean, you know, if you took that now, this season, you know, any team in the Premier League would snap your hand off for that sort of home form.
Yeah, and that's one of the startling things, is the calibre of the teams that they pass. And it was almost like they got to a point where every game they played at home was almost like a cup game. You know, there was a huge groundswell of goodwill for them, and team, you know, people, I think fans of most clubs wanted them to do well and to do justice to Upton Park in that last season. And yeah, they actually came to Anfield and won as well. And that was one, it's something that very rarely happens. I think it was the first time they'd beaten us in over 40 years at Anfield. And then, yeah, they beat us in the league at Upton Park and knocked us out. I think it was the FA Cup that they knocked us out of as well. So they got a great deal of entertainment. South of us, that seems. But yeah, you know, going back to the Leicester comparisons, yeah, Leicester's achievement. I think if it wasn't for Leicester's achievement, I think West Ham's campaign in that season would be much more remembered. And I think as well as that, I'm sure they were up in like fourth, certainly fifth place, and there might have been a result or two towards the tail end that brought them down to about seventh or something. So yeah, I think. That they were, you know, negatively flattered than by the finishing place. They should have really finished a place or two higher than they did. You know, fifth or sixth is going to sound better than seventh. You know, and they really should have. You know, and it's those missed opportunities as well. And Danny's alluded to it with that European campaign and to losing that final qualifier before going into the group stages, you know, it could have and probably should have been a great European campaign for West Ham that season. And the FA Cup defeat to Manchester United, having got the draw at Old Trafford, you know, these were the golden opportunities to put a silver lining onto the finish as well.
You're right. Obviously, Danny, you know, I'm going to ask you about this final game at Upton Park. But it's, you know, Stephen's made a great point there with not so much missed opportunity, but it was almost a what could have been end to the season that, you know, there must have been so much emotion, you know, mixed up with the, I suppose, with the final few games at Upton Park. Like you say, you know, as the season's drawing to a close, there's you're ticking these games off, you know, of teams that will never play again at Upton Park, and then you come to this, you know, this final home game at Upton Park, which, you know, is clearly going to be the highlight of the season for all, you know, West Ham United fans for that season. So just talk us through that last ever game at Upton Park.
Well, I'll definitely never forget it. I mean, I was at Bournemouth University at the time, so I got the train down in the morning. And because obviously I was a student looking to do multimedia journalism, I took a video camera with me. Because I thought, oh, I'm going to try and like film it and make like a documentary or something like that. And when I got on the train, I realised that there was absolutely no chance of me doing this because I was just going to, you know, sort of live in the moment and make sure I enjoyed every second of what I had as much as I could because I'd never get to do it again. So, yeah, I mean, we went into the fire mashup as we always did. And then when we started approaching the ground, it was just incredible. There were so many people, like, just there. There were probably thousands standing outside the ground. You know, loads of people went and they didn't even have tickets. So they literally just stood outside Upton Park just because they wanted to be there. And, you know, there's small things that I remember, like, there was this bloke who'd always sell the programmes, and normally he'd sort of be looking quite relaxed with all his programmes and his box and all that, but he looked so stressed because there was just so many people coming at him. I remember him having the box resting on his knee and one hand like dipping into the box to get the programme and the other just going back and forth taking people's money because they were so like desperate to get a programme from the last game. And then obviously there was a bit where the Man United bus window got smashed, and I must have actually been quite near where that happened because I remember there was a van, and as I was walking along I saw the bus and there was nothing wrong with it, and by the time that I'd got to the other side of the van, the window had smashed. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't actually see it happen, but I must have been pretty close to it. So yeah, then we sort of got into the ground about 45 minutes before it was meant to kick off, but because of the delay, I ended up being in there over an hour. But to be honest, I'm glad that I did, because I just spent the whole time just sort of looking around the stadium and just trying to take in every tiny detail. And then obviously the game kicked off and it was just mental. You had Diafrasako scoring early on. Anthony Martial comes back and scores twice. And I remember just being absolutely furious when he scored the second, because I thought, this is our big day. You know, this is the last ever game at Upton Park, and Anthony Martial is going to be the one to take it away from us. I remember thinking, it's not even Wayne Rooney, who's normally the one who scores against us. And then Mikel Antonio scored that header. And to be perfectly honest, I had to watch the game back to even remember Mikel Antonio scoring. I just couldn't remember it because I just had this complete rush. And my mind just completely blanked of what actually happened for that goal. So I actually watched it back quite a few times just to remember what had actually happened. And then obviously Winston Reid then went and scored the winner, and I've probably never celebrated a goal so hard. And I just remember because David De Gea had given it the big one to all the fans in the Bobby Moore stand when Martial scored his second, and someone went up to him or something like that. And I just remember looking down and seeing that, and then looking over to the corner flag, and Winston Reid was just going crazy, understandably, because he just scored the winner. And then, you know, there was this really weird feeling, because you want the final whistle to go, because you want West Ham to win the final ever game at Upton Park. But then you really don't want the whistle to go, because then the final game at Upton Park is over, and you know you're never going to watch any football there ever again. So yeah, obviously the final whistle did blow eventually. And they had the sort of ceremony where there was all like fireworks, and the cabs came out with the cameo and the lights, and they had former players in the stand speaking. And then after all that, they had a figure of Bobby Moore on the screen, and it just walked up and it flicked the light switch, and all the lights in the stadium went off. And that was the moment where I was like, man, like, this is actually over. Like, you know, we're never going to be here again. And when it came to leaving the grounds, you know, you sort of had people peeling the stickers off their seats, and you know, there were people walking out with these massive signs. And you know, I didn't really do anything like that, because I just wanted to remember everything exactly where it had been all that time. So yeah, I just found myself like touching the wall as I went out, and weird things like that. You know, when you think about it now, you're thinking, why did you like touch the wall when you were walking out of the stadium? But it's just because you know it's the last time you can ever do it. So yeah, it's definitely an unforgettable night. And my fear of it ending prematurely wasn't the case, because I ended up missing the last train back to Bournemouth. So I had to sit at Waterloo Station until, if I remember, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to sit outside on the steps, and it turned out there was a fellow West Ham fan there as well. So we just reminisced on old times for hours. And by the time I got back to Bournemouth, it was 9 o'clock in the morning, and I went to bed then.
Stephen, this is why we do this, isn't it? This is why we do this series, because you can just... I could never talk about West Ham United like that. I could never talk about Upton Park like that. I could, you know, and it's why we do it, and it's so. Unless you've been there and lived it, and unless it means that much to you, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, actual sides here, and we're talking about a particular season, and, you know, and clearly, you know, this last hour has been building up and building up to this moment of leaving Upton Park, and this is why, you know, this is Danny's side and why they're so important to him. But sort of listening there for the last sort of 4 or 5 minutes, I suppose, it's you can't create that. You either live it or you haven't lived it, and that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I think it's probably, you know, the most touching and pain, you know, passage that we've had on one of these podcasts, because you can feel the, you know, the emotion and the pain almost in Danny's voice there, in what he's saying, and I fully understand what he means there. You know, the concept of Liverpool possibly leaving Anfield was too much for me to think about, to the point that I'd countenance not going to home games and just going to away games and all sorts of scenarios, you know, all sorts of base scenarios of what would go on if they were to do it. And I had that deep sigh of relief that, you know, eventually the old stadium was reconstructed instead of moving along. And I can feel the pain of Danny there.
It's, I mean, you know, we're sort of at the hour, and I'm a bit loath to ask any more questions, because I quite like where that's finished. Like Stephen said, that raw emotion, and, you know, it probably is the most emotive, you know, passage that we've had in sort of 7, 8, 9 episodes of this. But I am going to have to ask them, and I suppose, you know, really all I'm left with asking you, Danny, and I think I'm going to know the answer, is, but, you know, this side and its legacy, you know, what do you think? Because we're still relatively recently, but what do you think will be the legacy of this side?
I think it would just be that, you know, they actually made the last season at Upton Park something worth living, and they gave it a good send-off. And I think each individual player will only truly get that recognition when they leave. So it's like, you know, you can even see Adrian, who left this summer. You know, there were times where, with Lucas Fabianski coming in, there was debates about, oh, is Adrian that good anymore? Because he's second choice keeper. So at the time, he was just the second choice keeper. But now that he's gone, you know, you can sit back and think, yeah, you know what, he was that keeper who helped us out in the final season at Upton Park. You know, Andy Carroll, I'd say the frustrations are probably a little longer lasting because of the fact that he was injured so much. But, you know, when I look back in 10 years' time, I won't remember the Andy Carroll that, you know, scored against Birmingham in the FA Cup when he came back from injury. I'm going to remember the Andy Carroll that scored a hat-trick against Arsenal in the final of the season at Upton Park. So yeah, it definitely... The legacy of that team is that they made... That they gave Upton Park a good send-off.
I mean, just thinking about that now, I said it would be the last question, but I've got another one now. I'm really sorry. How will it feel, and you might not be able to answer this, but how will it feel when the last player who has played at Upton Park, and it may well be, you know, Mark Noble, you know, I'm not sure, but when you lose that final player, who that last link to Upton Park, how is that going to feel?
To be honest, I do agree with you. It probably will be Mark Noble, who's the last one who played there. When Mark Noble retires, it's just gonna feel really weird, because as much as, like, he does get a lot of West Ham fans moan about him, and, you know, they sort of say that he's too slow on the ball and all stuff like that, but every single West Ham fan has to have some sort of appreciation for what he's done and the part that he played. And I'm convinced that when he does retire, he'll probably have some sort of role within the side, because it just seems impossible that he wouldn't. So, yeah, it's like he's sort of the last link to Upton Park. And to be honest, I've never actually been to the Upton Park site. I would like to sometime. But, you know, you have all the West Ham fans with their... they've had their picture with the Long Live the Boleyn sign and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, I've never really done that before. I would like to. I'll just have to find the sort of timing to do it when it feels like the right moment. Maybe when Mark Noble does retire, it will be. But yeah, it will definitely be very strange when the last player who played there retires and isn't around anymore. But I'd like to think that they'll still be part of the club in some capacity.
It's, you know, Stephen, it's been a great episode, and it's been different again to, you know, to other people's. It's, you know, this is it's a story of a side that's almost they're almost a subplot to the actual main story of this season. They just happen to be the players who played out, you know, in this final season at Upton Park, and it's almost become a tale of a season of losing almost the soul of the club, although, you know, hopefully they will argue that they haven't lost the soul of the club. But when you lose your ground and go into a new one, you do lose a little bit of something. And it's, these players are almost feel like they've been incidental characters within a far bigger story.
Oh, completely. You know, I can't put it any better than that, Stu, between yourself and Danny's words there. It sums it up perfectly, really.
You know, Danny, thank you so much for coming on. I'm hoping it hasn't been too painful. Sometimes these are quite painful for supporters to relive, depending on which seasons they pick.
Yeah, therapeutic as well.
Yeah, definitely. I've really enjoyed going back through it. And, you know, because obviously it was such a good time, you know, there's times where you can sort of feel goosebumps because you're reliving a certain moment. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Not at all. There's absolutely no need to thank, because like I say, it's been brilliant listening to it. And it's, when you watch something on television, or, you know, and we all saw the final game, but to actually speak to someone, you know, not so much even just someone who was there, but someone who it meant so much to, and it was such an integral part of the life, is, you can't replicate that. You can't imagine what it must have felt like. You have to speak to the people and the person who was there. So, like I say, you know, the thanks are all ours. Stephen, as always, thank you for joining us and being a part of it.
Not a problem at all. Sheer joy as always.
And all that's left, really, is for me to say thank you to the listeners. And please join us again on the next edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.